Nishant has made a very, I was just in the throes of reading his recent posting, Penumbra's Query for Shadow, which actually is more than what you read to us. It's also with a gloss of the... Okay. I should stress that you're all encouraged to sign up and to post thoughts. Okay, so we ended with a discussion of latentos and manifestos.
And charters.
And charters, yes. Charters and other constitutions. I called it a statement of intent, but in fact it's more than that, as you gathered from the... It has a deliberate...
And there is also objectives for community museum project, which Howard has. To add to...
I didn't understand, actually. Well, he said for the community museum project, there is sort of, we call it objective, okay, rather than a manifesto or statement of intent. Yeah.
And why? That was a clear choice of words. Why?
Mainly, we need that paragraph in order to raise money. Okay, it's a totally pragmatic consideration. And actually, the paragraph come upon, I think, maybe one or two projects that after one of two projects that we have already done. And in fact, the paragraph actually seems to make some sort of commitment, but without promising anything. So I think that's the art of writing the manifesto.
Yeah. Nishant, what are your thoughts on statements of intent, manifesto, and charters? I mean, when you founded your CIS, did you feel the need to strike out the way ahead with a manifesto or a statement of intent, or did you prefer the...
We thought about it quite a lot. There was actually... a lot of fighting that we had to do because there was a very clear idea from certain... Because we are a registered society and then there are too many cooks who are actively spoiling the broth all the time. So there was lots of pressure to basically come up with an institutional structure, some sort of a manifesto in terms of what the center is supposed to do and so on. We decided to be slightly more humble and we just have a vision. And we found the vision as a very helpful thing because... The vision is what is informing the different kinds of projects, programs, and missions that we might have. So now if we do have a manifesto for a particular kind of activity, it is the vision which is informing us, and the manifesto might dissolve, or that group might come to an end, but the vision has to perpetuate beyond that particular phrase. So we're still in the process of doing it. It's been a year and a half, and it's not really the vision in terms of where everybody is happy. So there are regular fights and debates and questions about it. But it has helped to call it a vision because the idea of a vision is that it can stretch till infinity and it doesn't have to collapse because one of the programs or the projects that has been informed by it would might not work or something. But I'm not sure that a manifesto always fails. I mean, when you look at Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto, for example, it is not a manifesto which is stated out in terms of just things which have to be done, but a manifesto which also then lays out a certain conceptual framework. You know, it's not just a thing of this is what needs to be achieved, this is what we are setting out to do, but a manifesto can sometimes also be what you're calling a statement of purpose, for example, but it's beyond that in terms that it's not just a bullet-pointed list, but an extremely complex conceptual framework which has informed now questions of the cyborg in social sciences theory at least. And even when you are refuting it, there is a certain way by which Haraway is inescapable, because of the way in which she charts the manifesto, where she's doing a historical laying out of that particular concept, but then she's also bringing in different kinds of political ideologies into it, and in the process creating this hyperspace of some sort within which, how do you paraphrase Haraway, within which, you know, bodies which are straddling multiple paradigms can exist, coexist, recreate themselves, in terms of monstrosities, in terms of cyborgs, in terms of simians and goddesses and what have you and so on. So I'm not sure if... I'm not so skeptical of manifestos, but then I have had very little experience with manifestos. in terms that I've never really been a part of making one. But for me, Haraway's manifesto has survived quite a lot, including a lot of refutation and a critique. But it does inform, in many strange ways, different things that people are doing. I mean, from Marxism to feminism to technology studies to artificial intelligence, and now this very uneasy category called a Marxist feminist philosophy, which is emerging and so on. And I think she's there, and it's doing interesting things. So for me, failure is not really all that scary either. For me, it would be interesting to chart that manifesto first and then see if it fails. And from within that failure, you could be almost Phoenician, perhaps. And, you know, look at, or maybe like Dido, and sit on your throne and look at Carthage and then kind of rebuild the city from there. I'm not particularly sure if a manifesto is necessarily about, in terms that if a manifesto fails, then it is an end point. Sometimes it might also lead to new kinds of beginnings, is a hint. But I'm seriously inexperienced when it comes to these, so I don't really know.
I think an organization or collective is more defined by what they do rather than the manifesto. Because of what I do, I have to read a lot of objectives or vision statements from, no matter it's NGOs or art organizations, they all look the same. Yeah, so it's defined by what they do. There's more, the track record is more important to me.
What does a manifesto do? Isn't a manifesto set out against something?
Yes.
Or, I mean, what are the origins of a manifesto? Is it, it's like a public declaration of principles and directions and ideas and so on and so forth, right? So.
I think that several points require some clarification. I'm not saying that manifestos inevitably lead to failure. The problem with some manifestos is that they succeed. The point, and manifestos are public declarations. They're made for them. They're declarations made both to a public and both in public space, and I would say in public time, and in some degree of perpetuity. It's not just for now; it's also for later. While I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, that I'm more interested in what people do as collectives rather than what they say they do. But there are times where saying what you do is really important. For instance, if you're an institution located squarely within the public domain, doing things with publicly funded money for a public purpose and a public agenda, then it's absolutely necessary that you have a transparent statement of intent. And if you didn't have one, I'd ask, why wouldn't you? Why didn't you? But the point is that we need to make distinctions between those kinds of public activity and also the life practice of artists, some of whose activity may be submerged and not, you know, so open and transparent in all its processes. Then again, I think it's interesting to make the distinction between charters and manifestos, because charters are a set of demands usually. And a set of demands from our times or from our world, which I'm always happy to make. But make them, in fact, as precisely and as politically and as pungently as possible, if need be. But a manifesto can also be a declaration of who you are. And I think that in the case of the Cyborg Manifesto case is a very interesting example, because the person writing the manifesto is not actually embodying the subjectivity of the cyborg. The cyborg manifesto would be a completely different thing if it had, in fact, been authored by a cyborg, right? So if we are invoking subjectivities that are as yet latent through a manifesto, for instance, the manifesto of the Communist Party produced the proletarian as a figure of political imagination in a certain sense. The consciousness that you are workers and that you have a world and that is all you can win or lose was actually produced by the manifesto. And that's, I think, an interesting case in point. And I'm hoping that someday it will have a chance to succeed. But meanwhile, every statement of declaration that you are this or that or the other is usually made in response, even if gratuitous, to some kind of understood implicit demand to explain yourself. And while as a public institution, such as SARAI or CIS or any such institution, that demand must always be vigilantly made of the institution. I'm very, very wary when that demand gets made of an artist's practice. And there are points where they overlap, as in the case of the fact that Rux Media Collective has a life with SARAI, but it also has a life without SARAI. And I am not very sympathetic to the idea that I would offer explanations of the life that I have without a public institution. So I hold my cards closer to the chest.
Thanks a lot. I mean, I needed that clarification a little, but I also thought the Cyborg Manifesto is interesting because it is informed by desire. And that is something that we've not talked about in terms of what the manifesto it is. If indeed a manifesto is to be created for this particular group or some sort of a charter, I think Rene actually talked about it very briefly. No, Monica talked about it very briefly in the morning, saying not about thought, but what about desire? And I think it's an undervalued thing. Because in many ways, for me, the question that Howard posed yesterday, which was about the hidden agenda, it wasn't so much about the agenda, but what are these desires and impulses which are being drawn out? And we haven't really articulated them very clearly in terms of, I'm still not very sure what each person is doing in this group or the space. I can hint, I can guess at it, but I'm not really very sure where it's kind of coming through. And sometimes desire becomes an interesting trope because it's an affective trope of bonding, of forming communities, of forming different kinds of relationships, which institutionally or formally might not be very easily forged.
I think, Monica, you wanted to say something, right? You wanted to, no, you didn't? Well, the question of desire is extremely crucial to charters, constitutions, and manifestos, it's for sure. Because if you permit a reference to a philosopher once again, Spinoza, in defining desire, and really it was, he's one of the key thinkers of a certain constructivist conception of desire. He said desire is the same as appetite with the awareness of appetite. So it's exactly the same thing, but it's self-conscious appetite. And that's why, and nothing could be more self-conscious, self-aware than a manifesto, because it is this public, or it's this publication of one's desire for the present and the future. And I think sometimes there's a confusion that manifestos are written not through desire, but through fear. Fear of what? In any collaborative endeavor, if collaboration is to be fruitful, it needs to be based on not similarity, but difference. Well, you think, why would it be based on difference? It's much easier to collaborate with people that you have similarities with, right? If you're the same, you know, then you get along, no problems. Except that the collaboration itself is of no particular interest, because you might as well just do it yourself. Collaboration's interesting when there is diversity and difference brought into that equation. But with that comes, or can come, not only a desire, but also a fear. A fear that someone, the other guy, is going to turn the tables on you and hijack your project, or hijack your part of the project, and that you'll find yourselves not collaborating, but as Rancière would say, with that part without a part. You would no longer, but if you want to be a stakeholder, you desire to hold that stake. And so the manifesto is your way of ensuring, often through words that you choose to insert, that you will be part of that project, that there is something in that constitution that you can hold on to. I was in Nepal recently, in Kathmandu, and met actually some of the constitutional lawyers who were framing, or are attempting to frame, the new Nepalese constitution. And it was extremely interesting. They were talking about enshrining minority rights in the constitution. Well, minority rights must be enshrined in that constitution because Nepal has an incredible linguistic and ethnic diversity. But the thing is that none of the stakeholders want the word minority rights to be used because they're afraid that they're not the minority that's being referred to. And so some suggest, well, we shouldn't put them in there at all. We should write the thing in a completely different way. And so it was, we actually took part in a brainstorming session about how to resolve this this problem. And I was struck the extent to which there was an overinvestment in words on the behalf of all the constituent parties involved. And it resonated with me because of my experience, very limited experience, but nevertheless quite an intense one, and based on friendships, but I must say based on some very nasty moments that had to be overcome through outside of the discussion process, in writing that simple charter of our very modest biennial college. Maybe you recognize some words that I've identified myself with. There are other words that I can identify with other people who were parties and stakeholders to that conversation. And I know that all of us had a desire to make this thing work, but I know we have very divergent desires as well, and I think that's probably the key to it perhaps working in spite of numerous obstacles. So it's that constituent diversity, which is at once the potential path to success, but also that thing that had to be somehow channeled through a very key choice of words. And I suppose something like that in the back of my mind was also what motivated this me to want to come and be part of this group in this discussion, this conversation in these past days. That was the desire, basically. And also the belief that these types of words, and maybe words is because you see, behind each word are almost an infinite number of sentences. Does Periphery have a charter?
I think we never thought about it, but like what I am just going to respond, like for funding reasons, definitely we have some kind of objective or vision which keep changing according to what we really, and we really don't know what is going to be the vision of Periphery next year, things. But yeah, so there are many things which I really, I think that's a new thing which I heard, the whole what should I talk about. I think that's what really worked for us, Latento. I think it's many things which is latent. Like I was telling few of you that many of the things which we start to initiate doesn't have a straight agenda. Like when we invite an artist from Bangladesh or something which we don't really comfortable with. So what we set out it to the public domain is not something which that the really that the vision or the aim of that bringing that artist in. So definitely there is that kind of politics which is really working, and while working with different kinds of partners, we have different manifestos or different visions or different aims and objectives. It's a kind of multiple kind of spheres, and I think we have also a deep connection with which is now kind of getting merged, because last 1.5 years because we are working inside Periphery, which is not a kind of institution, but still Design Machine Collective is working inside Periphery. So it's like this has been our kind of project, like which is very kind of a thing. And certain point of time, we have to take roles which we never set up to do. Like something like what I remembered 1.5 years ago, something like there was a huge, there was this very interesting conference which happened. Now there is a this kind of network which has become from this Europe and Asia. It's called Asia Borderland Network. It is basically initiated by SOAS, Leiden University, and few academic from different parts of the world. So there was this one academic from who actually belongs from Assam, but he teaches in New York. So he wanted basically to collaborate, and he thinks that, that's what he meant is that it is not very visually disseminated what basically this whole idea of this contestation of things. So he said, I want to do this conference, and I want you to do. Basically, he pushed us towards curation, and we definitely, we didn't never set out to be curators, but he pushed us towards curate, you know, kind of is creating a new space inside periphery, and that's what happens. I think very few of you must have heard about what we did one year ago. We curated a kind of the, you know, this quasi exhibition called Inner Lines, where we invited a few projects, a few already existing projects from different parts of whatever we were aware of, and then we took, we had to take that role, and within this conference we had to intervene and we had to play a role, and it was like an intermingling of this abstract terms in border studies and, you know, hood idea of this this exposition of art and film. So this I'll tell a little briefly about this curation and few art projects which was inside it. Definitely during that time everybody was talking about Amar's lightning testimonies. So even we requested Ramar to, and he was very he was very easily accessible, so he agreed to give only single channel thing, and he sent it to us. So this curation has two parts. One has some interesting art projects, and the second part was few films. So there's one project which we were really, was interesting, and that's become very interesting point of departure even for the conference, was this interesting piece of work by a Japanese artist called Satomi Matobas. It's her work on map of utopia. So she basically make maps. And the work, I think I can share today, I can show that thing, work I have in digital. So it's basically she juxtaposes different places and she creates her own maps of utopia. So this specific work was basically she was juxtaposing, she was from Hiroshima, and she juxtaposed the map of Hiroshima with map of America, where it appears that an American town was very near to a town in, in Japan. So that was kind of, and it was done in completely cartographic measurements and kind of a thing. So what I'm trying to say, it sometimes, it is still, I'm that's why I think before that I was trying to tell you that, you know, it's not by choice, but sometimes it's quite not very definite kind of, vision or kind of aims, what is really, happening. It's like, so we don't have one kind of a thing, yes, but it's kind of a multiple, thing which is happening by accidents and many more accidents. But yes, when we set out to start the Jamation Collective, it was basically purely, I will tell very honestly, it was purely an after effect of reading too much of Deleuze and nothing else.
I had a couple of questions which kind of come up, and maybe people who are more experienced might want to take them up. I was wondering if one of the reluctance to accept a manifesto is because does a manifesto become a containing document in terms that it doesn't allow you to change or transgress or transform? Is it always finite and etched in stone, so to speak? Is that one of the problems? And the second problem was this. Wouldn't it be more fruitful to have a manifesto which is written retrospectively rather than at the beginning of an event? Is it possible to construct a manifesto, let's say 5 years, 7 years into something, and then kind of also make it some sort of a genesis historical document of some sort?
May I? I think if one starts off with a manifesto, what happens is you start by defining yourself in that way. And then if you start to do something differently, you immediately get questioned. I mean, when we had our initiative, Open Circle, we began as an initiative. And we did not write any manifestos or anything. We just began doing stuff. And first, we started working with the thing of workshops. But then we realized that we didn't want to do workshops and it wasn't working for us. So we slipped out of that and we started doing study circles and we started doing other things. And then from there, we started doing interventions. And I guess from an initiative, we kind of transformed ourselves to a collective. You know, I mean, I think there's a difference. So we just kept slipping and, you know, doing different things as we thought we needed to do at that time. And yeah, because I feel if you write a manifesto, you're defining yourself. Whereas when I started my project, the Unicell thing, I clearly gave myself like a bracket to work within. And for that, I have like a little mission statement or like a thing, you know, it's like a 4-line thing. But and the Unicell thing pretends to be an organization. It's not an organization at all. But to make it seem more like an organization, I had to, you know, give it that kind of a... So I'll just read it out. It's just about 4-5 lines. Unicell is a proprietary concern that designs utility products for the citizens of today's overpopulated megalopolises. The products are thought out as a remedy to the abrasive, uncompromising urban conditions. Unicell undertakes works on behalf of the citizens and or the state. It looks into matters as an entity apart from the two, that is, it is neither a citizen's initiative nor an organ of the state, nor does either commission it. It is an independent body that identifies, studies, and implements projects on its own accord and funding. And then I also made posts within that, like the chief executive officer and creative divisional manager, installation supervisor, production cell in charge, etc. And, you know, just to make it feel more like a bureaucratic kind of a, or a, you know, like having a corporate structure or something of that sort. So I had to like give titles and names and write a little bracket within which I wanted to operate.
I'm trying to, this is exactly what I was thinking, but I can't understand the purpose of that. In a way, I mean, history is a kind of manifesto, if you know what I mean. There's you look back, and in that looking back, you have defined what that event was or what the process was, and that which some things rise to the surface, some things are made to rise, and some things are made to, sink. And that's an interesting thing of the writing of history as manifesto writing, in a way, because it defines what, how you will look at the future will be defined by this. So in a way, it becomes a declarative project in a subliminal way. But so I'm trying to understand what the function of a retrospective manifesto, which is different from, say, history writing could be or would be. And at this, I still haven't reached a conclusion, but what would you think a function of something like that would be?
For me, it would be an alternative historiography in many ways, but in some ways it also means that during the formative years, I mean, for example, when you say that there's a communist manifesto, for example, it means that there has been a certain amount of history which has happened, and there are people who are within it who are now extrapolating things out of what has happened and putting it together as a certain sort of a declaration, right? Is that... So basically then we're saying that the manifesto is necessarily a response to a certain kind of a condition. No.
There's certain, in the anthropophagic manifesto, there's also an anthropophagic manifesto which is coming out of Brazil, and it's as manifesto was a very fascinating one. But there's a futurist manifesto, there's a communist, these are the sort of the legendary manifestos, but perhaps what we've been trying to think through, maybe not so in the kind of condition of manifesto making, but also what happens around a manifesto. This is what, you know, as practice, and what happens around a manifesto is that people come together for the practice that the manifesto calls upon you to do. And as so you come together to do what the manifesto says, and when that deed is done, because manifestos usually, or when the deed cannot be done, whichever way it might be, you come apart again. You no longer remain a working body. And so, as a collective, for us, it's actually a working question. It's not a theoretical question, because if you want to work together and have been working together as three people for, you know, 16, 17, 18 years, the idea of things being resolved or achieved is contrary to our own survival as a collective. So for us, it became a fundamental difference in the way we saw our practice, because we did not see it as a kind of it's an open-ended practice, and there's no end to that. So therefore, the idea of a manifesto would be contrary to our, you know, species.
I was just basically, this is very, very off the head right now, so I was just basically thinking if there is a certain point in the formativity, let's say, that in a pre-formative age or a pre-formative life of a particular organization or a collective, I would find the manifesto extremely restrictive. But that when you reach a certain age where you are able to define in terms of who you are, then it could be a manifesto which basically says that this were the guiding principles which has informed us for X number of years, and this is now we are making a public declaration that this is what we are going to do. So it's
but that assumes that you can define.
Yeah.
Which as Shiddha said is a very tricky thing.
But also that's why you make work. I mean, the work that you make as an artist is also declarations of some sort, or communiques of some sort between you and the world, and sometimes to yourself and to your own history. Retaining a space for a multiple set of readings within work is usually, I think, good for the health of your work, because then you don't restrict the reasons to do what you have to do. I am absolutely clear that there are reasons and times and situations when you need to do manifestos, and not to do otherwise would be in bad faith. But, and there are different aspects of people's practices and different aspects of people's lives that require them. So if I were to enter into a situation of explicit political engagement in the real world of politics, not in the fake world of art as politics, in the real world of politics. In that world, I think manifestos have a function. You know, and those are engagements that some of us enter into from time to time, and sometimes they're explicit, sometimes they're not explicit, and they're not explicit also for very different, for very specific reasons. However, in the world of practice, of the practice of one's creative life, I would like to have always some room, you know, for withdrawal, for negotiation, for reticence, for disguise. Because in any case in the world, we are constantly asked to identify ourselves. In general in the world, there is a constant demand to produce some kind of credentials for being who you are. And at least in one's, in the space of one's artistic practice, I would hope that there'd be a little bit of room for, you know, a withdrawal from this presentation of credentials.
Shuddha, just to respond to that, so but there are people who would want to disguise their art practice, and so they want to have this sort of seemingly motivated agendas. Like, say, he has a organizational structure which has a, you know what I mean. So to work as an artist. And use a manifesto, not necessarily, it can be used as a ploy.
As a ruse, as a performative statement, that's fine. But then that's a manifesto at another level altogether. That's, you know.
But you will still stick to it in some sort
of... No, of course you can. We've constructed entire archival correspondences as a way of thinking about our practice. Now, we are very serious about it, yet you know what we mean when we create those.
Also, I thought every manifesto sort of comes retrospectively. You know, you arrive at a point when you say, let's now have a manifesto.
The other thing is that a manifesto is also an invocation. It's a call for somebody to do something, to be someone, to do something. And you have to, you have to make your judgment about whether you want to take that call, or you don't want to take that. Sometimes you need to do it.
But I think the one of the things that the manifesto is, and that's what makes a manifesto beyond objectives or charters or statements of purposes, is that it's somehow a declaration of the independence of the self from some previous condition. So it's making myself manifest, you know. I mean, so in that sense, you know, the cyborg manifesto and the communist manifesto are very similar things, which is very different from the surrealist manifesto, which is an entirely different set of things that are being said, that we will do something, whereas Marx is saying this is going to happen to you, and the cyborg manifesto also is talking about a condition of the world. What then these two registers have in common is freeing something from something. There's that element, yeah. So therefore, then the manifesto really, from a hegemonic structure, there is an element of declaration of independence. And then, therefore, I mean, it's interesting, then is what has been written there is at all relevant for a manifesto, or the act of being able to articulate a manifesto then becomes a more important moment. And that's why I think that's a tension, that the manifesto is so much about the moment of articulation and declaration. And then, you know, what you have written might not be that relevant really in the scheme of things, psychologically speaking.
I found the idea of retrospective manifesto very interesting. Well, the reason why CMP did not have a manifesto or mission statement or vision statement at the very beginning is because we don't know who we are. Yeah, because we have not tried out anything yet. So this is why we, after 1 year or two, when we set up the website, that we start thinking about a paragraph to describe ourselves. So, but I think this is not really a retrospective, but more like a midway. But another, I'm trying to push that idea a little bit further. It is to, can we have a manifesto every year, change every year, and then record all the changes we've made to the manifesto, like in a Word document. Okay, so then we have a lexicon of regrets, maybe.
like an annual report. Yeah. Annual retort.
But I keep thinking whether we really have a desire for any manifesto, and I found that we have not, okay? There's no desire at all to make any manifesto for ourselves. But when I think further about it, indeed we have, but not in the form of like saying or text articulation, textual articulation. But in fact, maybe Lee Tong Street, the street project, is already a manifesto, but visually, which indeed core into a lot of different social actions and events by putting out this visual image and then making things happen in a kind of indirect or visual way. So I don't know whether this could be a way to redefine the conception of manifesto other than a textual manifesto. We do it visually or in practice, like, can we do it?
The most reduced form of that would be a logo, no?
So logos
also sometimes have like a, you know, same role as a manifesto. And then that comes to the other kinds of languages which we use to describe ourselves, which is not just text.
Yeah, exactly. The logo is the reduced
form. The color, the flag, the logo, the, you know, the banner.
This is not a manifesto in the sense of an assertion of oneself in counter distinction to a hegemonic project, which I really think that it was a, Kaushik made that point earlier, I think it's...
A logo can't be that, you're saying?
I can't think of any flags that are that, no.
All the labor union flags and all the logos of all the anarchist associations and, you know... So
well, they have to...
Slogan, yeah, they all, like all other corporate logos look the same, you know, so, yeah. Or all manifestos which look the same. So, but just talking about how, like, the point he's brought about is representing yourself, or like that sort of that condensed form, which is maybe the manifesto. And they're pretty elaborate logos. If you like, you know, there'll be a, like, you know, 65 elements in it, and like there'll be a slogan underneath, and you know what I mean. So, and a lot of times people are expressing themselves in this daily iconography that they produce behind, you know, trucks or rickshaws or, you know, BD shops and, you know, so there's a lot of expression and which is trying to convey like another ethos and represent what it's trying to do, even if it's in the shadows or in the peripheries
of things, and they do not have that language, but they do have a language, and you know, that's why I, you know, try to say that maybe we have to learn new languages rather than you know, conflate everything into one.
Well, I'm always
that sounded like a manifesto, no? Yeah.
Well, I'm always very suspicious of iconophilia spilling over into a certain disdain for the articulated discourse, which is something that that is not infrequently encountered. I wanted to talk about a slightly different take on the manifesto, but one which is on news. When we initiated the Slacker Forum, the first, it's really funny. These guys are supposed to be slackers, right? But this guy called Andy Abbott, he didn't even wait for the forum to begin. He was so excited to go that he actually posted his piece before the forum itself officially opened. And he published it, what he calls Slacking, an Ethical Guide in 4 Easy Parts. And it's a very well written and extremely interesting user's guide, if you like. But it is sort of a manifesto. It has the proviso as a subtitle that read at your leisure, ignore, rewrite, or destroy. That's the sort of slacker discursive style which is almost de rigueur in these kinds of situations. He says, well, you can look on the site. It's read at your leisure, ignore, rewrite, or destroy. But it's in basically...
Rewrite and destroy is work. It's not slacking. it's a lot. That's more work than it, you know.
Yeah. Ignore is probably the...
Yeah, that's the only one.
But
yeah.
The thing is that what it really says in its 4 points, which are, 1, the indignity of speaking for others, because all slackers share this idea that there's nothing worse than having one's own situation explained to you by experts, right? 2, undoing the place of power. 3, minor inspiration. And 4, affinity for affinity. It's an extremely interesting document, but it at once asserts itself from the hegemonic logic of productivism, because all slackers share this idea that we don't live in a world of slacking, that slacking is actually a solution to the productivist mindset, which is hegemonic. But at the same time, you can't just sit around and do nothing as a response. You have to perform your slack. And so in that sense, it requires a manifesto as a call to slack, basically.
No, but we started.
Otherwise, people would lapse into working.
So you had that before you had anything. But did you have a logo at that point on your site when this went up? You have a logo, but news has. And does Rux have a way or type? Rux, yeah, Rux has a logo. CIS has a logo.
I wish we didn't have a logo. I wish I could say no, we don't have one. But you know.
Yeah. So
I work with these
iconophiles. And that's what I mean. Like, you know, because it's taken too casually. Okay, like let's put a logo. But like lots of times, or like we just choose one typeface and we stick to it because it's like seems consistent or whatever. But that consistency and choosing a certain thing is also telling you, and those can be read like a manifesto is, like, you know, and those typefaces, they belong to a certain, you know, aesthetic, a certain time and place, a certain genre, a certain, yeah. So, yeah. So you have a logo, Periphery has a logo. Your community museum project has a logo? Yeah? Yeah, you have the card, yeah. Who else has a logo? Kaushik, you have a logo?
Oh, yeah.
Tushar has a logo.
Oceans has
a logo. You have a manifesto? What does Oceans have? Manifesto, charter?
Vision, yeah.
Vision.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I'm saying you're making too much of a facetious slip between a metonymic representation and a manifesto, because the logo for, I mean, from purely institutional and experiential things, the logo is in no way designed to mobilize or make a declaration or to say, the logo in itself does not evidently define what CIS is or what is the kind of work that we do. It is a metonymic representation of a certain desire.
Yeah, but articulated. People, like design houses, treat their logo in the same importance you might treat your statement of purpose, or, and they don't necessarily have a nice paragraph written.
I'm not so sure about it, because all the design houses I have worked with have necessarily always also had very fancy sounding words about what is it that they do.
Yeah, but the logo comes first.
No, just because the metonymic representation comes first does not mean that it is a direct substitution for a manifesto, right? Because if you look at what other people have said, then the manifesto is about a moment of articulation where it becomes necessary to politically define yourself vis-a-vis a certain kind of a structure, and in the process then call for mobilizations of different kinds of communities and groups.
You're saying that because you can read the manifesto and deduce that from it. But
so
I'm
if
saying
you give
can
me an example of an instance where a logo has indeed been mobilizing point for a large community.
You didn't have a school badge.
Can I intervene?
At Unum Anam Sindh was my school badge, you know, and like there was a whole reading of that. Like there was a whole paragraph about the logo and that Latin statement, and you know, and
The badge. The thing about logos is that it is a certain kind of manifestation against a hegemony, but of confusion, of competitive forms. So it comes out in a dialogue with a logic of competitive forms, and it tries to brand itself as different. So there is a logic of self-presentation against a hegemony, but it's out of a hegemony of plurality that it's fighting. Now, Soviet poster art, or something like a Hindi film poster, where two lovers, like, you know, now, there's a manifesto element there because it's not talking about confusion, but it sees that there's one enemy against whom I'm coming out. And that's the difference between a logo and a manifesto type art. Because there, you know, when you look at Soviet poster art, it's very clear that there's a sickle hitting the world, which means I'm against the world of capitalism, which is hitting me. And so therefore, there's one enemy, one me. I'm emerging out of that hegemony. Or the lovers on a poster, society as such is my enemy, and I am exerting myself, and that is a manifesto kind of moment in poster art.
Yeah, and I agree there are different
the logo
things.
Is different.
Yeah. Like I'm not saying they're exactly the same. We understand they're different things, but they can play very similar roles, often very overlapping. Yeah.